I'm trying to do something that explains proteomics to a general audience, and that's about my level of understanding, too. As background, I have talked with some people at the Broad Institute. I've talked with SomaLogix here in town. I've talked with Henry Rodriguez, who's with NIH, spearheading the standardization program that they're working on. You're an interesting group to talk to because you're a commercial group.
Yes, we are. Has the same sort of relationship to proteins that genes have to genomics. When people talk about studying all the genes in an individual, they talk about genomics. We're doing a whole genome study on that person to try to find out what those genes are going to portend for either the health or the disease states of that particular individual. Well, those genes act by telling the body to produce proteins.
Yes, I think that genetic expression is so much more interesting than genes. And I'm intrigued by both what it can show diagnostically, but also what it can perhaps show people about their own health by changes in proteins over time. The whole field seems to be still trying to figure out which platform to use.
Proteins have been analyzed for many, many years using antibodies. That's the normal way we've done it. Antibodies are a very cheap way of using a body's natural way of recognizing proteins to assay them. The problem with antibodies are that they have to be produced by a living cell. And so commercially, we buy antibodies that are produced in goats or other animals by infecting those goats with a particular material, and then they produce antibodies against it, the cell's natural immune reaction, and then we extract from the blood of the animal, purify them, and then they are turned by other people into kits for which we assay proteins. That's by and large what's happened in proteomics.
Now, is that different from the aptamer technology that SomaLogix is using?
Aptamers you can think of as synthetically produced antibodies. Just like we use chemical methods now to make DNA, we can make pieces of DNA resemble antibodies in their ability to capture proteins. So that's what aptamers are. They're little pieces of unnatural DNA that capture proteins.
So for doing an aptamer-based technology, the proteins have to be known, and then it gets modified to make it possible for doing it with this synthetic form of antibody.
Yeah, the process that Larry has, Larry Gold of SomaLogix, if there is a protein, he uses a process called combinatorial chemistry. You generate a lot of different aptamers and see which of those aptamers with small changes in them actually capture the protein and actually develop aptamers for proteins. We can also look at proteins using mass spec, but where proteomics first came into being probably, 10 years ago, people used mass specs to discover what proteins were of interest in people with certain diseases.
It looked like with mass spec originally, it was a discovery tool.
Originally, we thought it was actually going to be the tool with which we measured things, because we thought that the proteins we were going to find that were associated with disease were going to be very new, novel proteins for which there wouldn't be antibodies. What we found is that most of the proteins that are associated with disease in these mass spec studies were proteins that we already had antibodies.
Okay.
So the one test that we have helped commercialize with Vermilion, the proteins that ended up being the signature for malignancy in the adnexal ovarian mass were all known proteins, some of which had FDA-cleared kits already available for them.
Well, yes, CA-125 and also LDL. You can't get much more common than LDL.
Also, beta-2 microglobulin is a very common protein. Whenever you have an infection or some sort of immune response, it's usually always around. It's something that's very commonly measured by us in patients with disease. So we thought we were going to have this new tool of mass spectrometry to analyze the proteins, and lo and behold, we found that a lot of them were just now discovery tools. We use the mass spec only for protein analysis where we have very, very subtle differences between proteins. Because even though the gene tells the body what protein to make, most times the protein then gets modified as it's traveling around the body. The body will stick sugars on it, it's called glycosylation, or phosphate groups on it, phosphorylation. Those are the really active chemical agents that do stuff. And mass specs are very good at basically weighing things. Whereas an antibody might recognize a protein with or without a sugar molecule attached to it, a mass spec can always tell whether the sugar molecule was attached to it or not.
Well, could it be that they are good at different things, these two technologies? Mass spec measures so many things. It's hard to look at least populous proteins in a set and see how they compare to the ones that are most populous.
And that's where Larry's technology comes in, because we use mass spec when we're looking for things that are present in very low concentration, because it's such a sensitive technique. But you're right, a lot of the common proteins like albumin almost swamp out everything. So a lot of the art now in mass spec for protein analysis is in these columns that we put like filters before the mass spec. These things will take out the bulk proteins that are in there and leave the proteins of interest behind. But they do add to the expense and the time it takes to do the assay.
Even if you're taking out the most bulk proteins, the difference between a high concentration protein and a low concentration one can still hide the one that's low concentration unless there's a very specific protocol for amplifying it. And I keep thinking of Yellowstone National Park, where if you have a dozen wolves and then you add a dozen more wolves, that will create a great more effect than if you have 4,000 bison and you add 12 more.
That's true. The mass spec can be very specific for looking at the differences between very small things. That's why we use it, for example, not in protein, but in measuring testosterone in children and women. There are some diseases where women or children have elevated testosterone levels. Well, they're elevated, but they're very low in the first place. So they're still very small.
When you know what you're looking for, mass spec is a great way to measure and count things accurately and also count for the modifications that can happen on a specific kind of protein. But if you don't know what you're looking for yet, for what the cause and effect might be, for what's making the difference between health and disease, mass spec can help you see what's there, but it can't help you amplify to compare different parts of what's happening and changing.
There are discovery studies, and mass specs are very good at telling you what's there. But then, you know, it takes a human, basically, to look at what's there and look to the samples they came from and look at some independent means for assessing the health or the disease state of those patients that gave those samples, and making a correlation between the two. So one of the things that has come out of proteomics is we get these concentrations of proteins that are associated with healthy patients or sick patients, or sometimes sick patients and much sicker patients. We still need to use mathematical techniques to correlate those concentration signatures, they're called sometimes, or people call them classifiers, so that we can actually have a diagnostic test. In proteomics, the measurement of the protein is just the first step. The second step, then, is applying the knowledge that we've gained from looking at the correlations between the different protein concentrations across a very large sample set to be able to then make the call. An assay is really only a call on whether something is something or it's not something. Unlike potassium, where you can measure one thing and say you either have high or low potassium relative to normal, with these proteomic tests, you have to do sometimes a calculation involving 5, 10, 20 different things to come up with a number that will then correlate with disease, non-disease, or let's say fast-growing prostate cancer as opposed to indolent prostate cancer.
Yes, don't you sometimes wish for the good old days of just measuring potassium?
Well, no, actually, I'm a cancer survivor. I've been 15 years now post my initial diagnosis, and I can tell you that with the state of diagnostics now, especially with some of the newer tests that are coming out, complexity shouldn't frighten people because it really can make a difference. When you don't have these types of tests, you're treated by statistics. You know, 80% of people will survive a certain amount of time, but it really doesn't tell you in a room of 100 which of those 80 will and which of the 20 won't. With some of these proteomic tools that we have now, we can focus in on the 20% who won't and try to treat them in some other way because we know that they won't be treated effectively with the standard of care.
You can avoid surgery for people who don't need it. You can step up the aggressiveness of treatment for somebody who might need that. You can tailor it to what seems to work with their particular set of proteins.
Yeah, you can tailor it as well as if there is nothing that's currently available. At least you can recommend these people to clinical trials at an early enough stage where there may be a benefit for them, let alone a benefit for the research community and those that come after them.
The OVA1 test.
It is the first proteomic test that came out of the, you know, sort of, I'll say, the great era of proteomic discovery. Vermilion used to be a company called Cyphergen, which was one of the first, along with CoreLogic, to embrace proteomics as a way of finding new assays. SomaLogic wasn't far behind them. Really, what SomaLogic has done is taken a technology where they're using nucleic acids now to detect the proteins, and they're using the same technology that you use for detecting genes. In genes, you know, the RNA sometimes is in vanishingly small amounts. And so because the gene is made up of four units that repeat and they're complementary, A's always go with T's and G's with C's, we can recreate a strand if we have just one leg of one side of the ladder. So in PCR, we can multiply one piece of RNA into billions of pieces, and that makes it easy for us to analyze. In mass spec or with antibodies, there's no multiplication that goes on. We have to hope that there's enough material there and have high sensitivity with mass spec in order to detect it. What Larry's actually done is, because he's used a little piece of a gene, essentially, to capture a protein, he can now use that same technique that we use to multiply genes to get enough sample to get enough now for protein analysis.
That explains why that technology can provide better amplitude, because
take
the teeny tiny nanometer
very
things.
Exciting. The fact that we don't have to rely on animals, we can use synthetic chemistry. You know, we use the same chemistry to make our drugs that we can now make our analytic probes for proteins. That in itself is revolutionary.
It gives the potential for the same platform that's used for discovery may be inexpensive enough to use for diagnostics. The materials are just much less expensive.
Well, like anything, it's a matter of scale. So we're hoping that certainly will be the case.
I should have said give or take $100 million of R&D.
Well, you know, we've obviously had a good relationship with Larry's company, and we are developing the tests for that. That's the nice partnership that we've had. They've done the R and we've done the D. We're putting the stuff that Larry has discovered through the same commercial hurdles, make sure that it's robust enough, because when you get into a laboratory, you know, you're not going to have PhD chemists making sure that every reaction is correct. You want these things to be able to run hundreds of thousands of times a day, being loaded up in automated instruments so that we can lower the cost to the healthcare system to have these new tests.
Are you speaking specifically about his small cell lung cancer test and the pancreatic tests that that he has in some kind of relationship with you, or are you speaking in the broader terms of a wellness chip someday?
No. I'm speaking specifically about a specific assay. So we're developing the lung cancer test. We're developing the pancreatic test. We're developing those tests based on his technology. I'm not speaking about, the wellness chip.
Boy, I sure wish someone would speak about the wellness chip. It's an idea out there in the future that I think we all can start to taste.
Well, it certainly will be a breakthrough. People have talked about, ways of monitoring wellness. But again, what is well? And well for one person may not be well for another. The technology challenges alone, I trust Larry to address, because they've done a fabulous job in terms of developing that technology for specific assays. So I'm not worried about that. But just to give you an idea, healthcare plans and the government wouldn't really have a way of reimbursing it right now. You almost have to devise a whole new scheme for rewarding people who want to test wellness.
A lot of consumers, once they understand that they can use proteins to check and see how their body responds to lifestyle, could be doing tests to see before and after a diet, before and after a drug is put into their body, before and after they shift to a major exercise change campaign. Knowing your proteins could start to be very motivating.
You have to conduct that study, though, that actually shows I can exercise and I can change my proteins because I'm alkylating my blood or I'm acidifying my blood, and my proteins will be different. But to be able to show that that causes either something beneficial with respect to maybe the prevention of diabetes, unfortunately, the only way to do that is to wait years until you know what the outcome of that person is and you've constantly measured all of those. The one thing that gives a laboratory that's vested in clinical diagnostics like Quest some pause is same things that we see with direct-to-the-consumer genetic tests. We employ a lot of genetic counselors to guide doctors in how to understand genetic tests. Not even patients, it's the doctors that need the help. To be able to put information into the public's hands could be very empowering, but it also could be very complex because there haven't been outcome studies done that show that perhaps there's real causes between longer life and certain protein patterns or even certain genetic patterns.
Yes, these are tests that don't have reference ranges on them yet, and that's confusing to people. And
it's more than reference ranges. There's actually not been a study that shows that changes in protein patterns equate with longer, better outcomes in either wellness or not. Need to find some people who didn't have the protein patterns and, for example, died from a heart attack sooner than people who had different protein patterns. But you'd also have to subtract out all the other causes. The medical community will put very high scrutiny on general claims of wellness. Studies need to be done to really make sure that people can use the information in a way that will be useful and effective. Mm-hmm. When we have that in hand, as you say, it could be very empowering to be able to finally have a tool to say, see whether or not we're effectively controlling pre-diabetic tendencies. This area is kind of fun because you get to speculate. You could really see these leading to dramatically new paradigms, really, in the way people would manage their own health. But it's not even in just their own health. People have been looking at whether or not certain proteins could predict whether you'll have a good outcome when you have a surgical implant, say a new knee or a new hip put in, or a certain pacemaker put in, or whether or not you might have a reaction to a Botox injection. So there's a, because basically the lingua franca of the body in terms of how things communicate with one another. You can almost put any proposal in front of a person who's looking at the different changing patterns of proteins and get a possible answer to a whole variety of questions.
You all see the big picture. You can see far into the future what's possible. And also, you're right there on the bottom line.
That's why people like SomaLogic and Vermilion have come to us. As I told Larry, after working many years to figure out how to get these aptamers to work and to capture proteins, I said, well, now the easy part's done, because the diagnostic has to have all of the technology built into it, but it has to be like an Apple and not a supercomputer.
When you told him that, did he laugh or cry?
Well, actually, he did something else, but we probably don't want it recorded.
Probably not.
And I'll tell you, over the last 2 years, as we've been working more intensely on this, he's remarked that his scientists would have never anticipated the problems that we've brought up and had to solve were problems at all, because it's very different when you're trying to make commercially robust tests that'll be reproducible and that will be as inexpensive as possible to perform.
Are you needing to anticipate providing labs with a little machine that's different than what they've had in them before in order to do this test, or is it something that would come in a cellophane wrapper that you would open up and you could test it right there in the lab, or will they need to send this test to a central lab that has the machines to handle this?
There are kits. You open up a box, and there may be some liquid reagents. There may be some little test tube-like plates in which you would put blood samples and mix these things. Or you might use the instruments that are already available in certain advanced laboratories and perform these in a more automated format. We would envision that we can supply the materials, but usually the way these tests occur is a laboratory like ourselves will bring them up because they are fairly complex. For example, Quest employs over 900 scientists, PhD scientists, and MDs in our laboratories. So we have a lot of technical resources and can bring up complex tests and get them to run very well. What we do over time then is to make them into a more simple format that can be used by other laboratories that may not have any PhDs, and it may be staffed by a medical director and medical technicians.
Or someday perhaps be a lab in Africa where they don't have anybody but one person handling what's happening and it's out in the bush.
We tend to talk about point-of-care testing and making things very simple for labs of low complexity. This particular technology, because it involves PCR, is probably a step away from being able to be run in a remote laboratory. But the nice thing about the Quest model is the person who founded our Nichols Institute, which really does our highly complex testing.
That was your esoterics lab a while back?
Yes. He said you shouldn't, have different medical care because one person lives next to Massachusetts General Hospital, another person lives out in the wilds of West Virginia.
Or in the wilds of Africa.
Or the wilds of Africa, as we do get samples from all over the world. It's easier to move the sample to the laboratory than it is to move the patient to the laboratory. So one of the things that we've done is, by having just a few laboratories and by having an extensive network of planes, and we have over 21 planes, we have thousands of vans that pick up samples all from doctors' offices and hospitals every day. We get the samples to the places that have the expertise to perform the tests and then electronically get the results back to the doctors who then give the results to their patients.
Sure, that makes a lot of sense. And And at the same time, I hear you saying that some of these new proteomics technologies may, after they get figured out, be affordable enough because the chemicals used are less expensive, or the style of how you throughput it so that you get a foolproof result might allow them to be distributed more broadly. And you like the idea that some of these tests might actually help you get away from using antibodies made from animals as the way to test the common things. Plus, it might give you some of the power to test the much more uncommon things and do it affordably, and maybe from one tube of blood.
All of what you said, we certainly are working on.
With just one tube of blood, they could find out everything.
Well, there are certain things that only genes could tell you. There's only certain things, for example, that potassium could tell you. For example, for a patient that needs to have their coagulation status of their blood measured, whether or not their warfarin is working correctly, you actually have to collect that in a different tube of blood with different stabilizers for the blood in order to analyze those samples properly for coagulation therapy. In some cases, we have serum that we collect. In other cases, we have plasma that we collect. We want the blood to clot. In some cases, we don't want the blood to clot. We've been striving to try to reduce the volume of things, but to get a robust measure of health, probably we'll always need to measure several analytes. Still, we'll have typical urine analyses on a separate subject. We've put into practice as a commercial laboratory a blood test for screening for colorectal cancer. So instead of a stool test, we can use a blood test now, which may be a lot more acceptable to a patient and may cause an increase in screening rates, which would be a great thing for the wellness of the population.
You've certainly persuaded me that we need more than one tube of blood after all.
Something that you don't appreciate as you're sitting there with having your blood drawn and seeing all these tubes seemingly being added on to the thing, but there is a good medical reason for the different types of tubes with the different colored stoppers. For each different colored stopper, there's a different set of additives and things in the tube for specific purposes.
Yeah, and this would, as this field gets more developed, I'm anticipating that it would reduce some of that, so that if someone wants a leptin test and somebody wants a serotonin test and somebody wants a something else test. But getting back to the proteomics tests, are the OVA1 and Larry Gold's tests the only proteomic style test where you're in a relationship with looking to develop them right now, or are these some of dozens that you're looking at right now?
Well, Quest is the largest commercial reference laboratory in the U.S., and therefore arguably the world. My job is pretty easy at times, because anybody that has a proteomic test, or really any diagnostic test, wants to talk to Quest, especially because we've had these great relationships with Larry's company and with Gail's company to help them develop things. I'm bound by some confidentiality agreements that we have, but there are more than just those companies actively looking to develop proteomic tests.
Do you have some kind of timeline where you predict that we'll see half a dozen proteomics-based tests or a dozen of them available to consumers for early diagnostics?
Earlier screening tests are always very, very difficult to bring into practice. You have to test somebody, and then you have to show that the test is negative, and then you have to wait some period of time to make sure that they really are negative.
Well, maybe I used the wrong term then, because I was assuming that that's where most of the proteomics market is for diagnostics and screening and fine-tuning tests.
Most of the people start out trying to develop these screening tests, but really, there's not a large financial incentive to develop screening tests. The way the government reimburses things and the way health plans think, if you you were going to test 200 million people a year, they wouldn't want to pay $1,000 or even $100 for that test. They'd want to pay $10 or $5 for that test because it's going to become such a huge expense when you multiply. And you have to do so much work to really prove that you have a screening test. You have to have samples in which you know the outcomes for 5 or 10 years out from patients and show that the negatives really were negative and the positives did become positive in some reasonable period of time.
This takes so much time, it just does not sound very American.
It's perverse. So what happens is Larry's test really interrogates lung nodules that have been found on an X-ray. His test is not for interrogating somebody who is asymptomatic or has no spots on their X-ray. So, you know, almost by definition, it's not really a screening test. It's a test for determining, helping to determine the malignant state or the benign state of a nodule. Very similar to OVA1. OVA1 is not a screening test. OVA1, the woman must be presenting with an adnexal mass, a lump, an ovarian mass, and she already has to have been considered for surgery. And this test makes sure that if the doctor thinks that the mass was benign, it gives a second opinion, essentially, from the laboratory to confirm that it is benign and you should go to a general surgeon, as opposed to, wait a minute, we caught some cancer here that may have slipped visual imaging or some other technique that's been used, really should send this woman to a gynecological oncologist or a debulking surgery rather than a cystectomy. Whereas the aspiration is that there are going to be these screening uses. If you look, proteomic and genomic tests have actually very narrow intended uses, and the FDA actually has been counseling people that that's what they're looking for. They're looking for narrow intended uses. They don't want tests to be used outside of things that data supports their use. You would not want to use the OVA1 test as a screening test on women because there's no data that shows that an asymptomatic young woman or older woman who tested positive to the test actually is in the early stages of ovarian cancer.
Are those tests being done? Those research studies to pave the way for that to be done as a early diagnostic test at some point?
There are lots of things going on. Quest itself doesn't engage in, again, the R part. We leave that to our partners.
Well, Nick, you've done a good job explaining to me why just the sheer realities of how long it takes to watch somebody through health and disease means that no matter what the technology is right now, it's going to take some time for these to become full-scale diagnostic tests.
Right. Sometimes we get lucky and doctors or researchers have been saving samples up for, let's say, 10 years. There are some studies that have been going on where people agree to come on for 10 years and come back every year, and they'll take blood samples from them. We call them retrospective samples. And in the course of 10 years, whether a patient has developed diabetes or whether they've developed heart disease or whether they've developed cancer is known to their doctors. And so sometimes we can accelerate that a little bit by using these retrospective samples. But the real gold standard is the prospective study where we sign people up, we do the test, and then we wait for the outcomes. And that does slow things down in terms of getting the new technology out into the hands of people. But the one thing I will tell you is that over the course of maybe the last 10 years, and maybe it's due to the fact that you know, there are more doctors now who are emerging who, used computers when they were undergraduates and are now savvy with the latest technology. But it has appeared that at least physicians in the field do want to know about new diagnostics and new tests. They do want to understand research on the latest assays that can help individual patients, and they are interested in wellness. And I think that has been accelerating more over the last 10 years than it had if I think about the first 10 years of.
And I think that the possibilities out there are helping people see the possibilities more with things like what you're doing. And, Wendy, you'd mentioned, you all had mentioned that you have a mass spec machine there. Are you using that to double check the diagnostics, or are you using it? Are you using it as a development tool for what's coming your way, or are you using it to actually do lab tests for people?
If I could just interject for a second, we do tandem mass spectrometry in our different laboratories, our esoteric labs, and we're primarily doing that for hormone testing, such as vitamin D and testosterone, which Nick alluded to before, and I'll let him expand on that. But I just want to come back to one point, which is, even though these assays that we're talking about, like OVA1 and perhaps the SumoLogic test for lung cancer, are not technically screening tests, I think that it's important for you and your readers to understand that they speak to a larger trend that's going on, which Nick was talking about before, which is really the personalization of how medicine is delivered to people. So this is a very important trend, and you're probably going to see in the future more and more tests that are for specific populations, because our understanding is becoming better about how medicines and disease work for the individual patient.
Yes, Wendy, when you mentioned in your email that the OVA1 has 80 million cases of possible ovarian cancer that it could cover, that was quite impressive. Does that mean that there's 80 million, but I didn't know quite how to sort that out. Is that in the lifetime of 80 million people, they are likely to need this test? Are likely to benefit from this test?
No, I don't know where that number comes from.
It's a number from, I think, Medicare that 80 million lives covered. Let me see.
That just refers to how many people, in terms of the health plans that cover OVA1, it covers 80 million lives potentially who could be getting access to OVA1 through their health plan.
Yeah, if you add it up all, like the Blue Cross of this state and Medicaid in that state, and you add it up for all of the plans that were issuing coverage of OVA1, if you added up all the number of patients that they covered, that would be 80 million people. But
okay,
those would include men and children who wouldn't be eligible for the test.
Right. And just to clarify, too, with Quest Diagnostics did a study where we estimated that there are about 1 million women who present with an adnexal mass each year, and about 300,000 surgeries are done to explore those masses. So you're looking, OVA1, it's not technically, as Nick pointed out, a screening test, but it's dealing with a large number of patients.
That is a lot. That is.
It is about 300,000. And that's why I said, at the outset, these tests are really important to those 20 people in the room of 100 that conventional diagnostics would only say, well, we can tell you that 20% of you are in one category, but we don't know which, so we'll give you all the medication, but only 80% of you will get well. The other 20% will have some bad side effects, but won't get any better. I think there's proteomics gives a lot of hope for those fine-tuned assays that will be able to tell people that, for example, we have they have a certain cardiac arrhythmia that will be very treatable by one particular drug rather than having to go in with a laser and kill heart tissue in order to calm down the misbeats that the heart's experiencing.
Yes, I think about the kids at Johns Hopkins with epilepsy, and nobody quite knows why it is that a ketogenic diet helps some of them that drugs don't help, and why it doesn't work sometimes and it does. I'll bet you someday there's going to be a proteomics test that help them identify which children will respond to which kind of treatment.
Oh, that's a very good example. There are lots of diseases, for example, that are caused because we're missing a specific enzyme to digest some particular food material, and those enzymes are all proteins. And so I can remember personally, I have a niece who 20-some-odd years ago was quite yellow. She had a distended, bloated abdomen and was going to get liver biopsies, literally sticking a needle into her liver to take tissue out to analyze, try to figure out what was wrong with her. Today we know that there are actually some tests that we can perform on these diseases to actually say, well, she's missing this or that particular enzyme, and then either say simply avoid foods that have those materials in them that need to be broken down by that enzyme, or provide the enzyme artificially.
Did she have celiac disease?
That in the course of her life, that technology was developed, and last year we got to go to her wedding.
Oh, that's great! Now, what was she missing? Made she was so sick? I can't help but wonder.
Oh, I can't remember, but it was a specific. There's a whole 20 years ago there was this whole class of diseases with the names of the doctors that had discovered them. And they had to go to places where the doctor was studying the disease because only 30 or 40 or 50 patients had been identified. Mm. Now they're considered a class of diseases. Some of them are called lysosomal storage disorders, but there's a variety of them, and they have a whole bunch of names that you probably hear on a House episode at some point in time.
Yeah. Well, you know, so it sounds like you all are taking a very long view of what the potential is here, while at the same time you're sitting on the bottom line and finding some real potential for some of these proteomic tests, narrow potential right now for some of them, and you're figuring out how to get them to market. And then you also have your mass spec machine there at the Nichols lab that you're actually using right now as the most efficient and accurate way to measure low concentration proteins such as some hormones.
It's not just one, it's over 120.
Wow, that's a lot.
Yeah, we're the largest purchaser of almost all medical testing, diagnostic testing laboratory equipment in the world.
And so you say 120 mass spec machines or 120 different proteins that you're measuring with your mass spec machine?
No, machines.
Well,
you should understand that there's about 5,000 hospitals in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And
there's what, about 20?
All of those hospitals, as a matter of fact, there's only a small handful that are going to be able to afford a mass spectrometer, which can run up to $500,000 fully installed and manned. And so rather than perform the test there and buy all the equipment, they'll simply send the test to us. Let's say there's two tests a week that a hospital has to do. On any one day, we may have 2,500 hospitals sending us samples. So in any week, whereas one hospital will see two tests, we'll see 5,000. So we've got to be able to run 5,000 tests a week for something that would be, in a typical community, only seen twice a week.
Okay, so you
that
have...
That gives you the idea why when we start out with these tests, we buy a lot of machines.
Sure.
In order to be able to do the volumes and turn the results around very quickly.
Is this a pretty new purchase for you?
A lot of money in automation to try to make those tests automated so that we can do them on fewer and fewer machines and reduce the cost.
Sure. And so are these machine purchases fairly new for you, or have you had them for a while?
We've had them for a while.
Like 5 years or 10 or 3?
At least 5 years.
Okay. And but they are diagnostics. You're using them for diagnostics of a lot of hard-to-find proteins, and you're using mass spec as the way to do it.
We're not fully using. I would say our mass specs' highest use are for vitamin D, which is not a protein, testosterone, which is not a protein, and some of the other steroids that we find in endocrinological disorders.
Well, you see, there's another thing I didn't know. I figured that all of those hormone kind of things would have a little protein in them somewhere.
Well, we can do that. You can do those tests using a technique called nephelometry, which does analyze them in sort of the same way that you would measure proteins. Mm-hmm. But the mass spec applications right now that we're using aren't for proteins. However, we can and do have some tests where we're looking at whether or not some the proteins are made up of peptides, which are the sort of building blocks of the protein. Sometimes there's diseases in which some of the peptides are missing from certain proteins, and we are developing those on mass spec assays for peptide-deleted protein analyses.
You're really backing all these technologies.
The reimbursement and the whole sort of intensity of the healthcare, you know, government focus of shrinking costs gives such a negative incentive to small companies. You know, they really have to find, I think, a partner, or they have to spend time raising a lot of money in order to get this. So Quest is happy to use, you know, its resources to help these come to help patients.
Well, thank you all for that.